I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Gravity had a good run, but it's time to feel the weightlessness of the Brooks Glycerin 21. These running shoes feature nitrogen-infused DNA Loft V3 cushioning. Brooks has even magnified the plushness to elevate the softness to new levels. And if you want extra support, find these same features in the Brooks Glycerin GTS 21. Learn more and shop now at brooksrunning.com. That's brooksrunning.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. That's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Miranda Campbell about reimagining the creative industries, youth creative work, communities of care. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
This is a great book. It does a lot of different things with lots of different examples from the creative industries. But I think at its heart is the title, the idea of kind of rethinking or reimagining, reframing the creative industries and thinking kind of differently about them. And the book has got a variety of different approaches in order to do this. And one of the big ones where the book kind of starts is this idea of kind of like ordinariness. And I was really taken by this because it kind of runs all the way through the book. So I wonder if you could introduce some of the, I suppose, kind of approaches or ideas that are in your analysis of creative industries with this idea of kind of ordinariness.
Yes, for sure. Thank you. So a lot of my push in this book is to refocus the creative industries, or in the title, to reimagine the creative industries and what they are and what they could be. In the beginning of the book, in order to do that work, I returned to some of the foundational premises of cultural studies, in particular, starting out with Raymond Williams and his proclamation that culture is ordinary from his 1958 essay. So going back there, and his kind of call to start our investigations or analysis from what is ordinary or what is everyday. And thinking about what that looks like, not in 1958, when Raymond Williams was writing that essay, Culture is Ordinary, but in the 21st century. So Raymond Williams writes about everyday forms of culture, like maybe something like singing along to the radio, or watching television, or meeting with friends and kind of recuperating those things as culture, what we do in our everyday. But also that has, you know, in his writing, quite a positive hue. Those are good and worthwhile things. And I very much agree with that. I opened the book thinking about this idea of ordinary and the everyday through my own experiences and a series of anecdotes about things I've experienced as a fan in the creative industries, or as a teacher or professor of creative industries, and as a researcher in creative industries, and having ordinary or everyday experiences that were actually quite disquieting or gave me pause about this thing called the creative industries and how I fit into it. For example, one of the anecdotes I open the book with is an experience of going to a very packed after-hours show at a loft space and having a really good time at that show and enjoying the music and enjoying the concert. But having this moment of realization while I was there that everyone could die in that space if there was an accident or an emergency just by how packed it was. And there was no exit. we all kind of bottlenecked in to enter, as is kind of quite common or ordinary and, you know, ad hoc or DIY spaces. After that experience and that kind of moment of reflection, there was a tragic fire in Oakland, California, at a warehouse space called Ghost Ship that resulted in 36 people dying in 2016. So that sounds quite dire and extreme, but kind of led me thinking about, you know, how what we take for granted as ordinary, these types of spaces, which are vital and important, sometimes called safe spaces for cultural production, can sometimes also be, you know, tragically and unsafe. And the need to, you know, find better ways to support these spaces and the forms of cultural production they incubate. Another example I start the book with is teaching a class to my undergraduate students in my Department of Creative Industries here at Ryerson University in Toronto. And in that class, it just so happened to have all young women in attendance one day when we were discussing conflict and abuse in the creative industries. And one young woman, one of my students, raised this question that really stuck with me. And she wanted to talk about whether or not being berated by her boss, that was just ordinary for the creative industries, and she was just going to have to learn to roll with that and get a thicker skin just to have a career in the creative industries. And that really gave me pause about my role as an educator, you know, preparing students to go into the creative industries. How am I preparing them to go into what? If this is just taken for granted as maybe a normal or ordinary experience of the creative industries. In recent years, we've had a lot of discussion about the problems of social inequality and abuse and harassment in the creative industries. You know, we're increasingly having conversations about problems like sexual misconduct, systemic racism, underrepresentation of women and people from marginalized communities. And these things are unfortunately quite tragically ordinary for the creative industries, but shouldn't be so. So my book is driven by an exploration of alternatives and more inclusive working practices, again, from that kind of everyday what are people doing perspective, looking for different lenses to make these kind of different alternative or more inclusive practices visible.
I guess the book is also critical of how we frame and understand creative industries. And quite early on in the book, you're quite open about you're not sort of retelling the entire sort of history of creative industries, but you do try and critique an overly sort of economic focus that comes with the idea. And I guess it'd be useful to hear, I suppose, what some of the kind of problems or the sort of limitations of just that economically focused definition are. Because it kind of sets up both your examples throughout the book, but also your critical perspective.
In the early part of the book, I try to look at where did this idea of creative industries come from, you know, without claiming to have a comprehensive history of the creative industries in the book, because most of the book, you know, wants to look at alternatives. But in order to do that, we first need to, you know, talk about what is the problem and where did this problem come from, and a particularly kind of overarching economic focus. The creative industries came out of a policy moment in the late 1990s, particularly in the United Kingdom and in Australia, and then exported worldwide as an idea that this could be a way to regenerate the economy out of post-industrial decline. That this could be something to turn to stimulate the economy, to create jobs. And there's kind of an enthusiasm and celebration about these forms of work in the late 1990s. This also kind of crystallized through academic work and academic discourse. You know, creative industries as a field of research, like I am in, and researchers like myself thinking about what is the relationship between culture and the economy? How does culture contribute to the economy, or what is the tension there? In this book, I question if this very notion of the creative industries as a coherent thing or a grouping really makes sense. In order to say that this has economic impact, a bunch of disparate fields have been put together. For example, the IT sector is often counted in the creative industries, but also performing arts. So you might have dance, large scale and small scale forms of cultural production. And I wonder if some of these things are, you know, kind of different in kind rather than different in degree. But my main focus in this book is questioning this kind of overarching economic focus that creative industries stimulate the economy or they boost the economy as their like their main reason to be celebrated. There's been a lot of critical work about this idea, you know, that we do have, you know, a growing sector of the economy with creative industries, but the quality of work might not necessarily be good for the majority of workers in terms of pay or lack of pay, but also fair and safe working conditions. So I try to raise some critical questions about what are we celebrating when we celebrate this economic impact? What are we celebrating for whom? And at what cost to whom are some critical questions I try to raise. But really, I try to refocus on social concerns. So, you know, putting the social alongside the economic. And by social, I mean people and the processes that people go through to create. And I raise the question of what does it look like to meaningfully and inclusively co-create, create together? If the creative industries do have this potential, what is it? And how could it be better realized, given that we increasingly talk about an experience of harm in the creative industries?
One sort of answer to that is this idea of care. And there's quite a lot of literature around care at the moment. But I think one of the things the book tries to do with care is not to sort of contrast care in opposition to economically focused versions of creative industries, but to say that it kind of reframes things like participating, getting control over creative practices, getting paid, you know, and kind of the book stresses, you know, that, you know, getting paid is still important. And the things you've been mentioning there are actually about, you know, the kind of questions of distribution about, you know, well, who gets to participate, who gets in, I think are, you know, much more kind of nuanced and become, I think, much more, I suppose, interesting questions when you view them through this lens of care. So where does care fit with the creative industries?
Yeah, I in this book, try to suggest care as maybe an alternative foundation or starting point, rather than kind of working towards inclusion in a flawed system. How can we maybe think about things differently from a different starting point? Care is one kind of lens or way to think about also some of the problems in the creative industries that I've mentioned or talked about. We can also see a lack of care in the creative industries or a lack of concern for well-being or for equality or fairness. I think care for the creative industries starts from a strong critique of capitalism and the pursuit or celebration of economic profit above all else, or above, you know, people and their well-being. In this book, I draw, of course, on feminist theories of care that in particular draw attention to the work of social reproduction, or basically feminist theories of care will say that's the work of, you know, attending to people and society to basically keep it afloat, whether that's in our homes or in our communities, you know, also in our workplaces or in our schools. This is all of the behind the scenes labor that is often devalued and then divided. I also see that space of social reproduction, that space of care, as potentially a space of social transformation. If it is not devalued, but instead seen as vital and kind of, you know, foregrounded, it can be a space from which we might be able to develop better practices of care. So in the book, I try to articulate, well, what does that mean, care for the creative industries, and what could it look like? Again, through researching people and practices and what alternatives exist. But I define care as thinking relationally and how we are all connected or embedded in a web of relations. I think for the creative industries, we can also think about economic values in a web of other values and practices like social and cultural values and how those intermesh. Care, and when we think relationally, also means recognizing structural barriers and discrimination, patterns of overrepresentation and underrepresentation and social inequality that we quite commonly find in the creative industries. But also it's more than just recognizing that there are problems. I think care is also a way to commit to new visions or new strategies or new practices that are more caring or more inclusive. So care can be that different foundation to start from. The book maps some of those alternatives by turning to youth and creative work that youth are spearheading, to collectives, to not-for-profit organizations. And some of these alternatives that I'm mapping might not be visible through an overarching economic lens. They might not be seen as important if we only look at economic profit. But the premise of the book is we can learn from how to do better in the creative industries from these more caring examples.
I mean, I'm tempted to kind of go straight to some of the examples which sort of form the later or maybe the kind of second half of the book. But I think slightly before that, and this is actually intertwined with your examples, it'd be good to reflect on the kind of pedagogical or sort of educational context, because that's really important, both, I think, to the book's focus on young people, but also to the idea of having very different environments for the creative industries. And it also actually sets up perfectly some of the examples from participatory research that the book gives in its kind of later chapters. So I wonder if you could say a bit about your kind of, I guess, sort of pedagogical practice and the role of education in creative industries.
Yes, for sure. So when we think about pedagogical practice or opportunities for teaching or learning or education, those often can be lacking in mainstream creative industries, where we might have a more cutthroat environment or a competitive environment. But where can we find space to learn, to try things out, to develop or grow, and to do that in a supportive environment alongside others? Those are some of the ideas that I think about when I think about pedagogy. I think those are important for young people entering the creative industries, but I actually think they're important lifelong, that we have those opportunities to grow and expand and develop in supportive ways. You know, at its best, creative work might offer that, right? An opportunity to create, to be creative, to collaborate meaningfully with others, to be learning, to be mentoring, to be teaching, you know, alongside others kind of in community-based ways. Those things are happening. And I try to turn to some of those examples in the creative industries rather than assume that that they're not possible, that a toxic environment is an ordinary status quo. There are ways of, you know, fostering those pedagogical spaces for education that ultimately might be more humane.
What about some examples then? So the kind of second half, or maybe the final sort of two or three chapters of the book are full of these brilliant and really kind of inspiring actually projects, but also full of the kind of the work that needs doing to make these very different visions of creative industries come to life. And so you talk about, and hopefully I've got these names right, Sketch, Vibe Arts, and Artreach, and you also tell the story of Rock Camp for Girls as well. And I wonder if you'd like to pick out a couple of those to maybe think through, I guess, kind of models of best practice for doing inclusive creative industries.
Yeah, and that's a good way of, thinking about what I'm trying to do through probably, as you say, the second half of the book, you know, kind of models of best practice for the creative industries from community settings, and like, where can we go to learn about alternatives? And I do want to present these examples in some ways as inspiring alternatives. When I was writing this book, I was in particular thinking about my undergraduate students and kind of writing for that audience. And again, going back to that example that I started with, of educating undergraduate students and teaching them, you know, in the classroom, preparing them through the Bachelor of Arts program that I teach in, and wanting to be able to tell them, you know, this is not, the problematic version of the creative industries is not the only thing. It's not what you need to expect. It's not what you need to learn to put up with. And the problem is not you and just learning to put up with, bad or harmful environments. There are other things, in the not-for-profit sector, in collectives, that might have more inspiring practices. But I'm also, cautious about being overly celebratory of those spaces and that work as well. It is challenging work. A lot of this work is volunteer-run, so it can result in problems of burnout. And these spaces are also not utopic. They are, places that experience their own challenges in terms of working practices and fairness. At their best, though, some of these alternatives or spaces are embedded in a spirit of reflexivity. Like, let's think about what we're doing and try to register some mistakes and correct them and move forward and do better. So rather than saying any one example is the be all and end all of how to have inclusion in the creative industries, I try to say, well, here are some models of best practice. Here are some alternatives alongside registering some of those challenges. I do name particular organizations that I've researched, but also say, those organizations will change over time. Some of them have their own problems and challenges that will surface over time. But, this kind of foundation of care is important to retain regardless. So for example, in one chapter, I look at some of the research I've done in the community arts sector here in Toronto. And the community arts sector, I try to say, is a sector of the creative industries, but is less economically driven. The purpose of the community arts is not necessarily to make a profit or to produce, products to sell on in a marketplace, but there's still economic imperatives there. People are employed in that sector. People go to that sector to learn about careers in the creative industries, especially young people often turn to community arts in their community context as an opportunity to learn and to be mentored and to access resources to develop creative careers. So I do say these are, economic spaces of career development and careers in themselves. But also alongside that, we can learn a lot from some of their social qualities of care and kind of reflexivity. In that chapter on community arts, across some of the community arts organizations that I research, I try to name some best practices, including anti-oppressive practice, which can look like conflict prevention, thinking about how people enter a space together, and how we can kind of set the stage for people to work together what diverse people might need, even to show up, you know, to be able to access the space, but while they're there, how to work together. Those are questions of accessibility, but also questions of affirmation, of validating people, meeting them where they're at, and supporting their growth. I also register the importance of employing people and funding them and paying them to learn, having entry-level positions that are paid so that people can do that work. I look at the importance of micro-funding as well, even small sums of money in terms of micro-grants can be incredibly impactful in terms of, you know, allowing people to develop their own projects and be entrepreneurial in socially engaged ways and to do projects with their community members that have funding. So we kind of get out of this assumption that people should be working for free or doing projects because they love them and because they're important. Sometimes that's even more present in a community sector where it's like, oh, we're being community engaged, we're doing things that are good for our communities. So we need to put in even more hours. In the community arts sector that I've researched, there is like some thought and gesture towards, you know, making sure those positions are paid. But, you know, rates of pay and kind of, you know, quality of employment can always be improved. Other characteristics of community arts that I register are fostering relationships, you know, meaningfully thinking about how can we work together? How can we support each other? What does mutual aid look like? Opportunities for mentorship, for learning, and attention to pedagogical practice, that there can be spaces and opportunities for open exploration or growth or learning. For example, one particular community arts project I look at in Toronto, it's called Sketch Working Arts. It's a beautiful facility, and you can enter in kind of a variety of ways. There's kind of low stakes art activities that are out. It operates, you know, as a drop-in center. You can go and kind of, you know, create some visual art. Materials are out and accessible. There's a variety of registered programs. You know, if someone is kind of interested in developing an art practice in a more focused way, for example, music or ceramics. And there's also entrepreneurial support in terms of, you know, starting a micro business or doing community activism or kind of, you know, creating some sort of project out of a creative practice. We would call that, you know, through an educational language, scaffolded support, right? So there's support for the person that is scaffolded in. Where are you? Where do you want to go? How can we help you go there? That is, you know, driven or led by the person who is, you know, seeking to explore and create and maybe also mobilize a creative career. So those are some of the qualities in the community arts sector that I try to register that might be specific to the particular projects or spaces in Toronto that I've researched. But again, I'm trying to kind of extrapolate or name some of these qualities and say, you know, what would mainstream creative industries look like if it was based in anti-oppressive practice? If there was a conflict prevention model, if there was, you know, attention to fostering relationships, if there was reflexivity on, you know, funding or employing people properly, you know, these are best practices that could better inform the creative industries writ large.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And this can be true, I guess, in the music industry as well. So the example of Rock Camp for Girls and the sort of broader rethinking of a music industry as a kind of community of practice rather than, as various other people have written about, as a kind of inherently exploitative, sort of highly unsafe space fit for young women. And that kind of Rock Camp for Girls story has a lot of parallels, I think, with places like Sketch and some of the, I guess, you know, again, standard practices of paying people, being inclusive, these kind of anti-oppressive approaches. And it'd be good to hear a little bit about that example as well, actually.
Yeah. Rock Camp Montreal is an organization that I formerly volunteered with and researched, and is a not-for-profit organization that is dedicated to fostering empowerment for girls and non-binary, trans, and gender non-conforming youth through music education. So this is a very different lens on, you know, what the music industry is. Starting from the perspective of let's foster empowerment for people who traditionally have not been fully present in the music industries. As you mentioned, you know, we increasingly have awareness that, you know, the music industries can be unsafe and exclusionary. So, you know, what else can be possible for those industries? Well, I look at organizations like Rock Camp as a community of practice, though, you know, an exit pathway could be someone who wants to go on to mobilize a music career. That's not like the primary first, like the first imperative, right? It's like first, let's start from, let's make you feel confident. Let's make you feel well. Let's introduce you to playing an instrument of your choice. Let's figure out how to write a song together. Let's have a performance and record it. Those are some of the things that happen at Rock Camp for Girls. So it does kind of result in, you know, the same outputs that happen in the music industry, like live performance and a recording. But it's not set up that, you know, going on to being a musician is necessarily what needs to happen. Like, how do we feel good about ourselves through making music? These are kind of like the potentials of the creative industries from a social or a cultural perspective. In that chapter, I look at the concept of a community of practice from Jean Lav and Etienne Wenger, but also try to talk about alternative communities of practice, because communities of practice in themselves can sometimes be exclusionary or mysterious or opaque. Like, how do I get in there, and what is it, and, you know, what does membership look like? Communities of practice are often talked about as spaces of learning by doing. You kind of come in through something like an apprenticeship model, or just kind of, you know, watching and participating and kind of gradually getting more involved. But things like indie music communities, you know, can seemingly be open But in fact, you know, reproduce the hegemonic norms of the mainstream in terms of gender or race or social class. Rockcamp Montreal tries to work on widening access and participation, right? How do we get in here and how do we participate together? Let's not take for granted that that's an easy thing. And this is set up for youth aged 10 to 17 are the campers who come in. But some of the premise of the book, like the community arts chapter, like these are good things for everybody, not just for young people learning. Some of the ways that Rock Camp Montreal thinks about widening access or participation is in making learning more visual. So for example, like commonly using flip chart paper, let's, you know, if we're working on songwriting, let's write down what we're doing, the different parts of the song, so that everyone in the band can see that and know where we're at. So getting out of the idea of like an individual songwriter who brings like a preset song, like here we are, let's kind of write that down together, using language that is inclusive. Music can be really a space of, you know, insider knowledge and being cool or uncool based on what you know. So kind of getting out of name dropping bands or genres and kind of talking about sounds or types of music, so that everyone can be on the same page about the types of music they're writing together. And also validating the interests that girls come in with, or non-binary or trans or gender non-conforming youth. Although Rock Camp has the word rock in its title, pop is really kind of a meeting ground for a lot of young people, and celebrating that, celebrating the music that people come in with, going back again to that kind of ordinary or everyday quality. It's like that's the music that young people listen to. That's good music. Let's learn how to play that music rather than, you know, reaching for really obscure or, you know, more insider forms of music. What people know is and what they like is good and valid, and a good starting place for learning how to make music collaboratively. In that chapter, I also talk about, well, actually working collaboratively is quite hard. Rock Camp Montreal fosters, you know, groups of youth learning an instrument and writing a song together over a 5-day period. So there still are those challenges of output, of product. If the youth or campers didn't want to do that, that would seemingly, you know, that would be fine. But the campers do. They, you know, they want to write their song and perform it live. So it is a challenging kind of race of time and output. And learning to work inclusively or collaboratively is not easy when most of our culture and society is not really set up in those ways. We still have a kind of more individually centric culture. So even if we are self-mobilizing into spaces that are explicitly feminist, it still could be a challenge to listen to others, to compromise, to cooperate. And those things take time, and those things are not easy.
I mean, there's so much more we could talk about with the book. There's the middle of the book has got a really good critique of, I suppose, some of the kind of fake or, you know, failing attempts to be inclusive within creative industries, often by kind of corporate bodies. There's even more examples, you know, from organizations that you've been working with, and there's a, you know, to take on actually the point you made about music being a particular kind of space for collaborative practice. Actually, there's a big discussion of the nature of space and how it helps us kind of rethink creative industries. But to wrap up, I'm quite interested in where this kind of agenda you've set out in the book, and I think it's an important agenda for not just actually creative industry scholars, but, you know, people who are working in the arts, in theatre, in the music industry, in film and television can kind of pick up this attempt at rethinking. But I'm interested in kind of where you go next and where, I suppose, the kind of the next steps for this agenda are, or as some people do, are you kind of, you know, agenda setting with a view that you're going to move on and do something a bit more different?
Both. I'm continuing to work on these ideas of care in quite practical ways. As I mentioned, writing this book, you know, I had kind of my undergraduate students in mind. I'm writing a book, hopefully, that they could read and find useful to learn about concepts and examples in the creative industries that are based in care. I have another book coming out in 2022 that is more like a communication skills textbook. It's called How to Care More, 7 Skills for Personal and Social Change. So that's not, you know, a creative industries focused book, but those are still, you know, where a lot of my examples come from based on the research I do. But those are skills like care or like listening, consent, inclusion, collaboration. A lot of these things are buzzwords now, like, oh yeah, we should all be collaborative, even inclusion, but are actually really challenging to do well and to do meaningfully. So that book is a skills-based book. Well, as I said, kind of a communication studies textbook that could be used in classrooms or just, you know, for people who might want to develop some more skills in those areas. I have you know, other creative industries focused work coming out, a co-edited collection called Creative Industries in Canada, that again is coming from this impulse of refocusing the creative industries. What else might be visible if we drop an overarching economic lens? What other, you know, forms of social practice and also creative practice can we talk about that, you know, do have economic considerations, but that might not be the main driver? So that book is from a Canadian perspective, which is my perspective, but I'm hoping it has interest to people who are interested in creative industries. There are chapters on things like podcasting and creative hubs and stand-up comedy and screen dance. So looking at, you know, different kinds of disciplines and forms of creative practice that we maybe have not heard about as much in the creative industries. And then I'm continuing to look at this idea of the everyday and lived experience. I'm also going to be co-editing a book series, putting out short books. The book series is going to be called Cultural Production and Everyday Life. What does cultural production look like in a more kind of ordinary or everyday circumstance? What forms of practice or what communities have we heard less about? From a cultural production perspective, I'm going to be co-authoring a short book to kick that series off called Cultural Production as Lived Experience. So on the whole, kind of continuing to work through these ideas of care and the lived experience and the everyday through a few more book projects that I have coming out this year and ongoingly.